and the opposite manifest strengths and weaknesses of entrant firms are consequences not of differences in technological or organizational capabilities between incumbent and entrant firms, but of their positions in the industry's different value networks. Technology S-curves and value networks. The technology S-curve forms the centerpiece of thinking about technology strategy. It suggests that the magnitude of a product's performance improvement in a given time period, or due to a given amount of engineering effort, is likely to differ as technologies mature. The theory posits that in the early stages of a technology, the rate of progress in performance will be relatively slow. As the technology becomes better understood, controlled, and diffused, the rate of technological improvement will accelerate. But in its mature stages, the technology will asymptotically approach a natural or physical limit, such that ever greater periods of time or inputs of engineering effort will be required to achieve improvements. Many scholars have asserted that the essence of strategic technology management is to identify when the point of inflection on the present technology's S-curve has been passed, and to identify and develop whatever successor technology rising from below will eventually supplant the present approach. Hence, the challenge is to successfully switch technologies at the point where S-curves of old and new intersect. The inability to anticipate new technologies threatening from below and to switch to them in a timely way has often been cited as the cause of failure of established firms and as the source of advantage for entrant or attacking firms. How do the concepts of S-curves and of value networks relate to each other? The typical framework of intersecting S-curves is a conceptualization of sustaining technological changes within a single value network, where the vertical axis charts a single measure of product performance, or a rank ordering of attributes. Incremental improvements within each technology drove improvements along each of the individual curves, while movement to new head technologies involved a more radical leap. Recall that there was not a single example in the history of technological innovation in the disk drive industry of an entrant firm leading the industry or securing a viable market position with a sustaining innovation. In every instance, the firms that anticipated the eventual flattening of the current technology and that led in identifying, developing, and implementing the new technology that sustained the overall pace of progress were the leading practitioners of the prior technology. These firms often incurred enormous financial risks, committing to new technologies a decade or more in advance and wiping out substantial bases of assets and skills. Yet despite these challenges, managers of the industry's established firms navigated the course with remarkable consistent agility. A disruptive innovation, however, cannot be plotted, as a chart shows, because the vertical axis for a disruptive innovation, by definition, must measure different attributes of performance than those relevant in established value networks. Because a disruptive technology gets its commercial start in emerging value networks before invading established networks, an S-curve framework, such as shown in another chart, is needed to describe it. Disruptive technologies emerge and progress on their own, uniquely defined trajectories, in a home value network, if and when they progress to the point that they can satisfy the level and nature of performance demanded in another value network, the disruptive technology can then invade it, knocking out the established technology and its established practitioners with stunning speed. Two studies illustrate clearly the innovator's dilemma that precipitates the failure of leading firms. In disk drives, and in the other industries covered later in this book, prescriptions such as increased investments in R&D, longer investment and planning horizons, technology scanning, forecasting, and mapping, as well as research consortia and joint ventures are all relevant to the challenges posed by the sustaining innovations whose ideal pattern is depicted in a former chart. Indeed, the evidence suggests that many of the best established firms have applied these remedies and that they can work when managed well in treating sustaining technologies. But none of these solutions addresses the situation in another study because it represents a threat of a fundamentally different nature. Managerial decision-making and disruptive technological change. Competition within the value networks in which companies are embedded defines in many ways how the firms can earn their money. The network defines the customer's problems to be addressed by the firm's products and services, and how much can be paid for solving them. Competition and customer demands in the value network, in many ways, shape the firm's cost structure, the firm's size required to remain competitive, and the necessary rate of growth. Thus, managerial decisions that make sense for companies outside a value network may make no sense at all for those within it, and vice versa. We saw in Chapter 1 a stunningly consistent pattern of successful implementation of sustaining innovations by established firms and their failure to deal with disruptive ones. The pattern was consistent because the managerial decisions that led to those outcomes made sense. Good managers do what makes sense, and what makes sense is primarily shaped by their value network. This decision-making pattern, outlined in the 6 steps that will follow, emerged from my interviews with more than 80 managers who played key roles in the disk drive industry's leading firms, both incumbents and entrants, at times when disruptive technologies had emerged. In these interviews, I tried to reconstruct, as accurately and from as many points of view as possible, the forces that influenced these firms' decision-making processes regarding the development and commercialization of technologies, either relevant or irrelevant to the value networks in which the firms were at the time embedded. My findings consistently show that established firms confronted with disruptive technology change did not have trouble developing the requisite technology. Prototypes of the new drives had often been developed before management was asked to make a decision. Rather, disruptive projects stalled when it came to allocating scarce resources among competing product and technology development proposals. Sustaining projects addressing the needs of the firm's most powerful customers almost always preempted resources from disruptive technologies with small markets and poorly defined customer needs. This characteristic pattern of decisions is summarized as follows. Because the experience was so archetypical, the struggle of Seagate Technology, the industry's dominant maker of 5.25-inch drives, to successfully commercialize the disruptive 3.5-inch drive is recounted in detail to illustrate each of the steps in the pattern. Step 1. Disruptive technologies were first developed within established firms. Although entrants led in commercializing disruptive technologies, their development was often the work of engineers at established firms using bootlegged resources. Rarely initiated by senior management, these architecturally innovative designs almost always employed off-the-shelf components. Thus, engineers at Seagate Technology, the leading 5.25-inch drive maker, were, in 1985, the second in the industry to develop working prototypes of 3.5-inch models. They made some 80 prototype models before the issue of formal project approval was raised with senior management. The same thing happened earlier at Control Data and Memorex, the dominant 14-inch drive makers, where engineers had designed working 8-inch drives internally, nearly 2 years before the product appeared in the market. Step 2. Marketing personnel then sought reactions from their lead customers. The engineers then showed their prototypes to marketing personnel, asking whether a market for the smaller, less expensive, and lower performance drives existed. The marketing organization, using its habitual procedure for testing the market appeal of new drives, showed the prototypes to lead customers of the existing product line, asking them for an evaluation. Thus, Seagate marketers tested the new 3.5-inch drives with IBM's PC division and other makers of XT and AT-class desktop personal computers, even though the drives had significantly less capacity than the mainstream desktop market demanded. Not surprisingly, therefore, IBM showed no interest in Seagate's disruptive 3.5-inch drives. IBM's engineers and marketers were looking for 40 and 60 megabyte drives, and they already had a slot for 5.25-inch drives designed into their computer. They needed new drives that would take them further along their established performance trajectory. Finding little customer interest, Seagate's marketers drew up pessimistic sales forecasts. In addition, because the products were simpler, with lower performance, forecast profit margins were lower than those for higher performance products, and Seagate's financial analysts, therefore, joined their marketing colleagues in opposing the disruptive program. Working from such input, senior managers shelved the 3.5-inch drive, just as it was becoming firmly established in the laptop market. This was a complex decision, made in a context of competing proposals to expand the same resources to develop new products that marketers felt were critical to remaining competitive with current customers and achieving aggressive growth and profit targets. "We needed a new model," recalled a former Seagate manager, "which could become the next ST-412, a very successful product generating $300 million sales annually in the desktop market that was near the end of its life cycle. Our forecasts for the 3.5-inch drive were under $50 million because the laptop market was just emerging, and the 3.5-inch product just didn't fit the bill." Seagate managers made an explicit decision not to pursue the disruptive technology. In other cases, managers did approve resources for pursuing a disruptive product, but in the day-to-day decisions about how time and money would actually be allocated, engineers and marketers, acting in the best interests of the company, consciously and unconsciously starved the disruptive project of resources necessary for a timely launch. When engineers at Control Data, the leading 14-inch drive maker, were officially chartered to develop CDC's initial 8-inch drives, its customers were looking for an average of 300 megabytes per computer, whereas CDC's earliest 8-inch drives offered less than 60 megabytes. The 8-inch project was given low priority, and engineers assigned to its development kept getting pulled off to work on problems with 14-inch drives being designed for more important customers. Similar problems plagued the belated launches of Quantum's and Micropolis's 5.25-inch products. Step 3. Established firms step up the pace of sustaining technological development. In response to the needs of current customers, the marketing managers threw impetus behind alternative sustaining projects, such as incorporating better heads or developing new recording codes. These gave customers what they wanted and could be targeted at large markets to generate the necessary sales and profits for maintaining growth. Although often involving greater development expense, such sustaining investments appeared far less risky than investments in the disruptive technology. The customers existed, and their needs were known. Seagate's decision to shelve the 3.5-inch drive in 1985 to 1986, for example, seems starkly rational. Its view downmarket, in terms of the disk drive trajectory map, was toward a small total market forecast for 1987 for 3.5-inch drives. Gross margins in that market were uncertain, but manufacturing executives predicted that costs per megabyte for 3.5-inch drives would be much higher than for 5.25-inch drives. Seagate's view upmarket was quite different. Volumes in 5.25-inch drives with capacities of 60 to 100 megabytes were forecast to be $500 million by 1987. Companies serving the 60 to 100 megabyte market were earning gross margins of between 35 and 40%, whereas Seagate's margins in its high-volume 20-megabyte drives were between 25 and 30%. It simply did not make sense for Seagate to put its resources behind the 3.5-inch drive when competing proposals to move upmarket by developing its ST-251 line of drives were also being actively evaluated. After Seagate executives shelved the 3.5-inch project, the firm began introducing new 5.25-inch models at a dramatically accelerated rate. In 1985, 1986, and 1987, the numbers of new models annually introduced as a percentage of the total number of its models on the market in the prior year were 57, 78, and 115%, respectively. And during the same period, Seagate incorporated complex and sophisticated new component technologies, such as thin-film disks, voice coil actuators, RLL codes, and embedded SCSI interfaces. Clearly, the motivation in doing this was to win the competitive wars against other established firms, which were making similar improvements, rather than to prepare for an attack by entrants from below. Step 4. New companies were formed, and markets for the disruptive technologies were found by trial and error. New companies, usually including frustrated engineers from established firms, were formed to exploit the disruptive product architecture. The founders of the leading 3.5-inch drive maker, Connor Peripherals, were disaffected employees from Seagate and Miniscribe, the two largest 5.25-inch manufacturers. The founders of 8-inch drive maker Micropolis came from Pertec, a 14-inch drive manufacturer, and the founders of Shugart and Quantum defected from Memorex. The startups, however, were as unsuccessful as their former employers in attracting established computer makers to the disruptive architecture. Consequently, they had to find new customers. The applications that emerged in this very uncertain, probing process were the mini computer, the desktop personal computer, and the laptop computer. In retrospect, these were obvious markets for hard drives, but at the time their ultimate size and significance were highly uncertain. Micropolis was founded before the emergence of the desk-side minicomputer and word processor markets, in which its products came to be used. Seagate began when personal computers were simple toys for hobbyists, 2 years before IBM introduced its PC. And Connor Peripherals got its start before Compaq knew the potential size of the portable computer market. The founders of these firms sold their products without a clear marketing strategy, essentially selling to whoever would buy. Out of what was largely a trial-and-error approach to the market, the ultimately dominant applications for their products emerged. Step 5. The entrants moved upmarket. Once the startups had discovered an operating base in new markets, they realized that, by adopting sustaining improvements in new component technologies, they could increase the capacity of their drives at a faster rate than their new market required. They blazed trajectories of 50% annual improvement, fixing their sights on the large, established computer markets immediately above them on the performance scale. The established firm's views downmarket and the entrant firm's views upmarket were asymmetrical. In contrast to the unattractive margins and market size that established firms saw when eyeing the new emerging markets for simpler drives, the entrants saw the potential volumes and margins in the upscale, high-performance markets above them as highly attractive. Customers in these established markets eventually embraced the new architectures they had rejected earlier, because once their needs for capacity and speed were met, the new drive's smaller size and architectural simplicity made them cheaper, faster, and more reliable than the older architectures. Thus, Seagate, which started in the desktop personal computer market, subsequently invaded and came to dominate the mini computer, engineering workstation, and mainframe computer markets for disk drives. Seagate, in turn, was driven from the desktop personal computer market for disk drives by Connor and Quantum, the pioneering manufacturers of 3.5-inch drives. Step 6. Established firms belatedly jumped on the bandwagon to defend their customer base. When the smaller models began to invade established market segments, the drive makers that had initially controlled those markets took their prototypes off the shelf, where they had been put in Step 3, and introduced them in order to defend their customer base in their own market. By this time, of course, the new architecture had shed its disruptive character and become fully performance competitive with the larger drives in the established markets. Although some established manufacturers were able to defend their market positions through belated introduction of the new architecture, many found that the entrant firms had developed insurmountable advantages in manufacturing cost and design experience, and they eventually withdrew from the market. The firms attacking from value networks below brought with them cost structures set to achieve profitability at lower gross margins. The attackers, therefore, were able to price their products profitably, while the defending, established firms experienced a severe price war. For established manufacturers that did succeed in introducing the new architectures, survival was the only reward. None ever won a significant share of the new market. The new drives simply cannibalized sales of older products to existing customers. Thus, as of 1991, almost none of Seagate's 3.5-inch drives had been sold to portable laptop manufacturers. Its 3.5-inch customers still were desktop computer manufacturers, and many of its 3.5-inch drives continued to be shipped with frames permitting them to be mounted in XT and AT-class computers designed to accommodate 5.25-inch drives. Control Data, the 14-inch leader, never captured even a 1% share of the mini-computer market. It introduced its 8-inch drives nearly 3 years after the pioneering startups did, and nearly all of its drives were sold to its existing mainframe customers. Miniscribe, Quantum, and Micropolis all had the same cannibalistic experience when they belatedly introduced disruptive technology drives. They failed to capture a significant share of the new market, and at best succeeded in defending a portion of their prior business. The popular slogan, "Stay close to your customers," appears not always to be robust advice. One instead might expect customers to lead their suppliers towards sustaining innovations and to provide no leadership or even to explicitly mislead in instances of disruptive technology change. Flash memory and the value network. The predictive power of the value network framework is currently being tested with the emergence of flash memory, a solid-state semiconductor memory technology that stores data on silicon memory chips. Flash differs from conventional dynamic random access memory, DRAM, technology, in that the chip retains the data even when the power is off. Flash memory is a disruptive technology. Flash chips consume less than 5% of the power that a disk drive of equivalent capacity would consume, and because they have no moving parts, they are far more rugged than disk memory. Flash chips have disadvantages, of course. Depending on the amount of memory, the cost per megabyte of flash can be between 5 and 50 times greater than disk memory. And flash chips are not as robust for writing. They can only be overwritten a few 100,000 times before wearing out, rather than a few million times for disk drives. The initial applications for flash memory were in value networks quite distant from computing. They were in devices, such as cellular phones, heart monitoring devices, modems, and industrial robots, in which individually packaged flash chips were embedded. Disk drives were too big, too fragile, and used too much power to be used in these markets. By 1994, these applications for individually packaged flash chips, socket flash in industry parlance, accounted for $1.3 billion in industry revenues, having grown from nothing in 1987. In the early 1990s, the flash makers produced a new product format called a flash card. Credit card-sized devices on which multiple flash chips, linked and governed by controller circuitry, were mounted. The chips on flash cards were controlled by the same control circuitry, SCSI, Small Computer Standard Interface, an acronym first used by Apple, as was used in disk drives, meaning that in concept, a flash card could be used like a disk drive for mass storage. The flash card market grew from $45 million in 1993 to $80 million in 1994, and forecasters were eyeing a $230 million flash card market by 1996. Will flash cards invade the disk drive makers' core markets and supplant magnetic memory? If they do, What will happen to the disk drive makers? Will they stay atop their markets, catching this new technological wave? Or will they be driven out? The capabilities viewpoint. Clark's concept of technological hierarchies focuses on the skills and technological understanding that a company accumulates as the result of the product and process technology problems it has addressed in the past. In evaluating the threat to the disk drive makers of flash memory, someone using Clark's framework, or the related findings of Tushman and Anderson, would focus on the extent to which disk drive makers have historically developed expertise in integrated circuit design, and in the design and control of devices composed of multiple integrated circuits. These frameworks would lead us to expect that drive makers will stumble badly in their attempts to develop flash products if they have limited expertise in these domains, and will succeed if their experience and expertise are deep. On its surface, flash memory involves radically different electronics technology than the core competence of disk drive makers, magnetics and mechanics. But such firms as Quantum, Seagate, and Western Digital have developed deep expertise in custom integrated circuit design through embedding increasingly intelligent control circuitry and cache memory in their drives. Consistent with the practice in much of the ASIC, application-specific integrated circuit industry, their controller chips are fabricated by independent third-party fabricators that own excess clean room semiconductor processing capacity. Each of today's leading disk drive manufacturers got its start by designing drives, procuring components from independent suppliers, assembling them either in its own factories or by contract, and then selling them. The flash card business is very similar. Flash card makers design the card and procure the component flash chips. They design and have fabricated an interface circuit, such as SCSI, to govern the drive's interaction with the computing device. They assemble them either in-house or by contract, and they then market them. In other words, flash memory actually builds upon important competencies that many drive makers have developed. The capabilities viewpoint, therefore, would lead us to expect that disk drive makers may not stumble badly in bringing flash storage technology to the market. More specifically, the viewpoint predicts that those firms with the deepest experience in IC design, Quantum, Seagate, and Western Digital, will bring flash products to market quite readily. Others, which historically outsourced much of their electronic circuit design, may face more of a struggle. This has indeed been the case to date. Seagate entered the flash market in 1993 via its purchase of a 25% equity stake in SunDisk Corporation. Seagate and SunDisk together designed the chips and cards. The chips were fabricated by Matsushita, and the cards were assembled by a Korean manufacturer, Anam. Seagate itself marketed the cards. Quantum entered with a different partner, Silicon Storage Technology, which designed the chips that were then fabricated and assembled by contract. The Organizational Structure Framework. Flash technology is what Henderson and Clark would call radical technology. Its product architecture and fundamental technological concept are novel compared to disk drives. The organizational structure viewpoint would predict that, unless they created organizationally independent groups to design flash products, established firms would stumble badly. Seagate and Quantum did, indeed, rely on independent groups and did develop competitive products. The Technology S-Curve Framework. The technology S-curve is often used to predict whether an emerging technology is likely to supplant an established one. The operative trigger is the slope of the curve of the established technology. If the curve has passed its point of inflection, so that its second derivative is negative, the technology is improving at a decreasing rate, then a new technology may emerge to supplant the established one. One chart shows that the S-curve for magnetic disk recording still has not hit its point of inflection. Not only is the areal density improving, as of 1995, it was improving at an increasing rate. The S-curve framework would lead us to predict, therefore, that whether or not established disk drive companies possess the capability to design flashcards, flash memory will not pose a threat to them until the magnetic memory S-curve has passed its point of inflection and the rate of improvement in density begins to decline. Insights from the Value Network Framework. The Value Network Framework asserts that none of the foregoing frameworks is a sufficient predictor of success. Specifically, even where established firms did not possess the requisite technological skills to develop a new technology, they would marshal the resources to develop or acquire them if their customers demanded it. Furthermore, the Value Network suggests that technology S-curves are useful predictors only with sustaining technologies. Disruptive technologies generally improve at a parallel pace with established ones. Their trajectories do not intersect. The S-curve framework, therefore, asks the wrong question when it is used to assess disruptive technology. What matters instead is whether the disruptive technology is improving from below along a trajectory that will ultimately intersect with what the market needs. The Value Network framework would assert that even though firms such as Seagate and Quantum are able technologically to develop competitive flash memory products, whether they invest the resources and managerial energy to build strong market positions in the technology will depend on whether flash memory can be initially valued and deployed within the value networks in which the firms make their money. As of 1996, flash memory can only be used in value networks different from those of the typical disk drive maker. Another chart plots the average megabytes of capacity of flash cards introduced each year between 1992 and 1995, compared with the capacities of 2.5 and 1.8-inch drives, and with the capacity demanded in the notebook computer market. Even though they are rugged and consume little power, flash cards simply don't yet pack the capacity to become the main mass storage devices in notebook computers. And the price of the flash capacity required to meet what the low end of the portable computing market demands, about 350 megabytes in 1995, is too high. The cost of that much flash capacity would be 50 times higher than comparable disk storage. The low power consumption and ruggedness of flash certainly have no value and command no price premium on the desktop. There is, in other words, no way to use flash today in the markets where firms such as Quantum and Seagate make their money. Hence, because flash cards are being used in markets completely different from those Quantum and Seagate typically engage, palm-top computers, electronic clipboards, cash registers, electronic cameras, and so on, the Value Network framework would predict that firms similar to Quantum and Seagate are not likely to build market-leading positions in flash memory. This is not because the technology is too difficult or their organizational structures impede effective development, but because their resources will become absorbed in fighting for and defending larger chunks of business in the mainstream disk drive value networks in which they currently make their money. Indeed, the marketing director for a leading flash card producer observed, "We're finding that as hard disk drive manufacturers move up to the gigabyte range, they are unable to be cost competitive at the lower capacities. As a result, disk drive makers are pulling out of markets in the 10 to 40 megabyte range and creating a vacuum into which flash can move." The drive makers' efforts to build flash card businesses have in fact floundered. By 1995, neither Quantum nor Seagate had built market shares of even 1% of the flash card market. Both companies subsequently concluded that the opportunity in flash cards was not yet substantial enough, and withdrew their products from the market the same year. Seagate retained its minority stake in SanDisk, renamed SanDisk, however, a strategy which, as we shall see, is an effective way to address disruptive technology. Implications of the Value Network Framework for Innovation. Value networks strongly define and delimit what companies within them can and cannot do. This chapter closes with five propositions about the nature of technological change and the problems successful incumbent firms encounter, which the Value Network perspective highlights. 1. The context, or value network, in which a firm competes has a profound influence on its ability to marshal and focus the necessary resources and capabilities to overcome the technological and organizational hurdles that impede innovation. The boundaries of a value network are determined by a unique definition of product performance, a rank ordering of the importance of various performance attributes differing markedly from that employed in other systems of use in a broadly defined industry. Value networks are also defined by particular cost structures inherent in addressing customers' needs within the network. 2. A key determinant of the probability of an innovative effort's commercial success is the degree to which it addresses the well-understood needs of known actors within the value network. Incumbent firms are likely to lead their industries in innovations of all sorts, architecture and components, that address needs within their value network, regardless of intrinsic technological character or difficulty. These are straightforward innovations. Their value and application are clear. Conversely, incumbent firms are likely to lag in the development of technologies, even those in which the technology involved is intrinsically simple, that only address customers' needs in emerging value networks. Disruptive innovations are complex because their value and application are uncertain according to the criteria used by incumbent firms. 3. Established firms' decisions to ignore technologies that do not address their customers' needs become fatal when two distinct trajectories interact. The first defines the performance demanded over time within a given value network, and the second traces the performance that technologists are able to provide within a given technological paradigm. The trajectory of performance improvement that technology is able to provide may have a distinctly different slope from the trajectory of performance improvement demanded in the system of use by downstream customers within any given value network. When the slopes of these two trajectories are similar, we expect the technology to remain relatively contained within its initial value network. But when the slopes differ, new technologies that are initially performance competitive only within emerging or commercially remote value networks may migrate into other networks, providing a vehicle for innovators in new networks to attack established ones. When such an attack occurs, it is because technological progress has diminished the relevance of differences in the rank ordering of performance attributes across different value networks. For example, the disk drive attributes of size and weight were far more important in the desktop computing value network than they were in the mainframe and minicomputer value networks. When technological progress in 5.25-inch drives enabled manufacturers to satisfy the attribute prioritization in the mainframe and minicomputer networks, which prized total capacity and high speed, as well as that in the desktop network, the boundaries between the value networks ceased to be barriers to entry for 5.25-inch drive makers. 4. Entrant firms have an attacker's advantage over established firms in those innovations. Generally, new product architectures involving little new technology per se that disrupt or redefine the level, rate, and direction of progress in an established technological trajectory. This is so because such technologies generate no value within the established network. The only way established firms can lead in commercializing such technologies is to enter the value network in which they create value. As Richard Tedlow noted in his History of Retailing in America, in which supermarkets and discount retailing play the role of disruptive technologies, the most formidable barrier the established firms faced is that they did not want to do this. 5. In these instances, although this attacker's advantage is associated with a disruptive technology change, the essence of the attacker's advantage is in the ease with which entrants, relative to incumbents, can identify and make strategic commitments to attack and develop emerging market applications, or value networks. At its core, therefore, the issue may be the relative flexibility of successful established firms versus entrant firms to change strategies and cost structures not technologies. These propositions provide new dimensions for analyzing technological innovation. In addition to the required capabilities inherent in new technologies and in the innovating organization, firms faced with disruptive technologies must examine the implications of innovation for their relevant value networks. The key considerations are whether the performance attributes implicit in the innovation will be valued within the networks already served by the innovator, whether other networks must be addressed or new ones created in order to realize value for the innovation, and whether market and technological trajectories may eventually intersect, carrying technologies that do not address customers' needs today to squarely address their needs in the future. These considerations apply not simply to firms grappling with the most modern technologies, such as the fast-paced, complex, advanced electronic, mechanical, and magnetics technologies covered in this chapter. Chapter 3 examines them in the context of a very different industry, earth-moving equipment. Chapter 3. Disruptive Technological Change in the Mechanical Excavator Industry. Excavators and their steam shovel predecessors are huge pieces of capital equipment sold to excavation contractors. While few observers consider this a fast-moving, technologically dynamic industry, it has points in common with the disk drive industry. Over its history, leading firms have successfully adopted a series of sustaining innovations, both incremental and radical, in components and architecture. But almost the entire population of mechanical shovel manufacturers was wiped out by a disruptive technology, hydraulics, that the leaders, customers, and their economic structure had caused them initially to ignore. Although in disk drives, such invasions of established markets occurred within a few years of the initial emergence of each disruptive technology, the triumph of hydraulic excavators took 20 years. Yet, the disruptive invasion proved just as decisive and difficult to counter in excavators as those in the disk drive industry. Leadership in Sustaining Technological Change. From William Smith Otis' invention of the steam shovel in 1837 through the early 1920s, mechanical earth-moving equipment was steam-powered. A central boiler sent steam through pipes to small steam engines at each point where power was required in the machine. Through a system of pulleys, drums, and cables, these engines manipulated frontward scooping buckets. Originally, steam shovels were mounted on rails and used to excavate earth in railway and canal construction. American excavator manufacturers were tightly clustered in northern Ohio and near Milwaukee. In the early 1920s, when there were more than 32 steam shovel manufacturers based in the United States, the industry faced a major technological upheaval, as gasoline-powered engines were substituted for steam power. This transition to gasoline power falls into the category that Henderson and Clark label radical technological transition. The fundamental technological concept in a key component, the engine, changed from steam to internal combustion, and the basic architecture of the product changed. Where steam shovels used steam pressure to power a set of steam engines to extend and retract the cables that actuated their buckets, gasoline shovels used a single engine and a very different system of gearing, clutches, drums, and brakes to wind and unwind the cable. Despite the radical nature of the technological change, however, gasoline technology had a sustaining impact on the mechanical excavator industry. Gasoline engines were powerful enough to enable contractors to move earth faster, more reliably, and at lower cost than any but the very largest steam shovels. The leading innovators in gasoline engine technology were the industry's dominant firms, such as Bucyrus, Few, and Marion. 23 of the 25 largest makers of steam shovels successfully negotiated the transition to gasoline power. One chart shows there were a few entrant firms among the gasoline technology leaders in the 1920s, but the established firms dominated this transition. Beginning in about 1928, the established manufacturers of gasoline-powered shovels initiated the next major, but less radical, sustaining technological transition to shovels powered by diesel engines and electric motors. A further transition, made after World War II, introduced the arched boom design, which allowed longer reach, bigger buckets, and better downreaching flexibility. The established firms continued to embrace and succeed with each of these innovations. Excavation contractors themselves actually pioneered a number of other important sustaining innovations, first modifying their own equipment in the field to make it perform better, and then manufacturing excavators incorporating those features to sell to the broader market. The impact of disruptive hydraulics technology. The next major technological change precipitated widespread failure in the industry. Beginning shortly after World War II, and continuing through the late 1960s, while the dominant source of power remained the diesel engine, a new mechanism emerged for extending and lifting the bucket. Hydraulically actuated systems replaced the cable-actuated systems. Only 4 of the 30 or so established manufacturers of cable-actuated equipment in business in the 1950s, Inslee, Caring, Little Giant, and Link Belt, had successfully transformed themselves into sustainable hydraulic excavator manufacturers by the 1970s. A few others survived by withdrawing into making such equipment as huge cable-actuated drag lines for strip mining and dredging. Most of the others failed. The firms that overran the excavation equipment industry at this point were all entrants into the hydraulics generation. J.I. Case, John Deere, Drott, Ford, J.C. Bamford, Poclain, International Harvester, Caterpillar, O&K, Demag, Liebherr, Komatsu, and Hitachi. Why did this happen? Performance demanded in the mechanical excavator market. Excavators are one of many types of earth-moving equipment. Some equipment, such as bulldozers, loaders, graders, and scrapers, essentially push, smooth, and lift earth. Excavators have been used to dig holes and trenches, primarily in three markets. First and largest, the general excavation market, composed of contractors who dig holes for basements or civil engineering projects, such as canal construction. Second, sewer and piping contractors, who generally dig long trenches. And third, open pit, or strip mining. In each of these markets, contractors have tended to measure the functionality of mechanical excavators by their reach, or extension distance, and by the cubic yards of earth lifted in a single scoop. In 1945, sewer and piping contractors used machines whose bucket capacity averaged about 1 cubic yard, best for digging relatively narrow trenches, while the average general excavation contractor used excavators that hefted 2.5 cubic yards per scoop, and mining contractors used shovels holding about 5 cubic yards. The average bucket capacity used in each of these markets increased at about 4% per year, a rate of increase constrained by other factors in the broader system of use. The logistical problems of transporting large machines into and out of typical construction sites, for example, helped limit the rate of increase demanded by contractors. The emergence and trajectory of improvement of hydraulic excavation. The first hydraulic excavator was developed by a British company, J.C. Bamford, in 1947. Similar products then emerged simultaneously in several American companies in the late 1940s. Among them, the Henry Company of Topeka, Kansas, and Sherman Products, Inc. of Royal Oak, Michigan. The approach was labeled Hydraulically Operated Power Takeoff, yielding an acronym that became the name of the third entrant to hydraulic excavating in the late 1940s, HOP2. Their machines were called backhoes because they were mounted on the back of industrial or farm tractors. Backhoes excavated by extending the shovel out, pushing it down into the earth, curling or articulating the shovel under the slice of earth, and lifting it up out of the hole. Limited by the power and strength of available hydraulic pumps, seals, the capacity of these early machines was a mere 1/4 cubic yard. Their reach was also limited to about 6 feet. Whereas the best cable excavators could rotate a full 360 degrees on their track base, the most flexible backhoes could rotate only 180 degrees. Because their capacity was so small and their reach so short, hydraulic excavators were of no use to mining, general excavation, or sewer contractors, who were demanding machines with buckets that held 1 to 4 cubic yards. As a result, the entrant firms had to develop a new application for their products. They began to sell their excavators as attachments for the back of small industrial and farm tractors made by Ford, J.I. Case, John Deere, International Harvester, and Massey Ferguson. Small residential contractors purchased these units to dig narrow ditches from water and sewer lines in the street to the foundations of houses under construction. These very small jobs had never warranted the expense or time required to bring in a big, imprecise, cable-actuated, track-driven shovel, so the trenches had always been dug by hand. Hydraulic backhoes attached to highly mobile tractors could do these jobs in less than an hour per house, and they became extremely popular with contractors building large tracked subdivisions during the housing booms that followed World War II and the Korean War. These early backhoes were sold through tractor and implement dealerships, accustomed to dealing with small customers. The early users of hydraulic excavators were, in a word, very different from the mainstream customers of the cable shovel manufacturers, in size, in needs, and in the distribution channels through which they bought. They constituted a new value network for mechanical excavation. Interestingly, just as the performance of smaller architecture disk drives was measured in different metrics than the performance of large drives, weight, ruggedness, and power consumption versus capacity and speed, the performance of the first backhoes was measured differently from the performance of cable-actuated equipment. The metrics featured most prominently in early product literature of hydraulic backhoes were shovel width. Contractors wanted to dig narrow, shallow trenches, and the speed and maneuverability of the tractor. An excerpt from an early product brochure from Sherman Products for its Bobcat hydraulic backhoe illustrates this. Sherman called its Bobcat a digger, showed it operating in tight quarters, and claimed it could travel over sod with minimum damage. The Bobcat was mounted on a Ford tractor. Ford subsequently acquired the Sherman Bobcat line. The featured attributes, of course, were simply irrelevant to contractors whose bread was buttered by big earth-moving projects. These differences in the rank ordering of performance attributes defined the boundaries of the industry's value networks. Another table charts the rate of improvement in bucket size that hydraulics engineers were able to provide in the new excavator architecture. The maximum available bucket size had reached 3/8 cubic yard by 1955. 1/2 cubic yard by 1960, and 2 cubic yards by 1965. By 1974, the largest hydraulic excavators had the muscle to lift 10 cubic yards. This trajectory of improvement, which was far more rapid than the rate of improvement demanded in any of the excavator markets, carried this disruptive hydraulics technology upward from its original market through the large mainstream excavation markets. The use of hydraulic excavators in general contracting markets was given a boost in 1954, when another entrant firm in Germany, Demag, introduced a track-mounted model that could rotate on its base a full 360 degrees. The response to hydraulics by the established excavator manufacturers. Just as Seagate Technology was one of the first firms to develop prototype 3.5-inch drives, Bucyrus Erie, the leading cable shovel maker, was keenly aware of the emergence of hydraulic excavating technology. By 1950, about 2 years after the first backhoe appeared, Bucyrus purchased a fledgling hydraulic backhoe company, the Milwaukee Hydraulics Corporation. Bucyrus faced precisely the same problem in marketing its hydraulic backhoe as Seagate had faced with its 3.5-inch drives. Its most powerful mainstream customers had no use for it. Bucyrus Erie's response was a new product, introduced in 1951, called the Hydro-Hoe. Instead of using three hydraulic cylinders, it used only two, one to curl the shovel into the earth and one to crowd or draw the shovel toward the cab. It used a cable mechanism to lift the shovel. The Hydro-Hoe was thus a hybrid of the two technologies, reminiscent of the early transoceanic steamships, outfitted with sails. There is no evidence, however, that the Hydro-Hoe's hybrid design resulted from Bucyrus engineers being stuck in some sort of cable-based engineering paradigm. Rather, the cable lift mechanism was the only viable way at that time, based on the state of hydraulics technology, to give the Hydro-Hoe the bucket capacity and reach that Bucyrus marketers thought they needed to appeal to their existing customers' needs. An excerpt from an early Hydro-Hoe product brochure notes the differences from Sherman's marketing approach. Bucyrus labeled the Hydro-Hoe a drag shovel, showed it in an open field, and claimed it could get a heaping load on every pass, all intended to appeal to general excavation contractors. Rather than commercialize the disruptive technology in the value network, in which the current attributes of hydraulics were prized, Bucyrus tried to adapt the technology to fit its own value network. Despite this attempt, the Hydro-Hoe was still too limited in capacity and reach, and did not sell well to Bucyrus customers. Bucyrus kept its Hydro-Hoe on the market for over a decade, attempting periodically to upgrade its performance to make it acceptable to its customers, but the machine was never commercially successful. Ultimately, the company returned to the cable shovels that its customers needed. Bucyrus Erie was the only maker of cable-actuated shovels known to have launched a hydraulic excavator between 1948 and 1961. All of the other manufacturers continued serving their established customers well and prosperously. In fact, the largest makers of cable-actuated excavators, Bucyrus Erie and Northwest Engineering, logged record profits until 1966, the point at which the disruptive hydraulics technology had squarely intersected with customers' needs in the sewer and piping segment. This is typical of industries facing a disruptive technology. The leading firms in the established technology remain financially strong until the disruptive technology is, in fact, in the midst of their mainstream market. Between 1947 and 1965, 23 companies entered the mechanical excavation market with hydraulic products. Another study, which measures the total number of active entrants and established firms offering hydraulic excavators, net of the companies that had exited, shows how completely the entrants dominated the hydraulic excavator market. In the 1960s, some of the strongest cable shovel makers introduced shovels with hydraulics. Almost all of these models were hybrids, however, like Bucyrus Erie's Hydro-Hoe, generally employing a hydraulic cylinder to articulate or curl the bucket and using cables to extend the bucket out and to lift the boom. When used in this way in the 1960s, hydraulics had a sustaining impact on the established manufacturers' products, improving their performance in the mainstream value networks. Some of the methods that engineers found to use hydraulics on the cable excavators were truly ingenious. All of this innovative energy, however, was targeted at existing customers. The strategies employed by the excavator manufacturers during this period highlight an important choice that confronts companies encountering disruptive technological change. In general, the successful entrants accepted the capabilities of hydraulics technology in the 1940s and 1950s as a given, and cultivated new market applications in which the technology, as it existed, could create value. And as a general rule, the established firms saw the situation the other way around. They took the market's needs as the given. They consequently sought to adapt or improve the technology in ways that would allow them to market the new technology to their existing customers as a sustaining improvement. The established firms steadfastly focused their innovative investments on their customers. Subsequent chapters will show that this strategic choice is present in most instances of disruptive innovation. Consistently, established firms attempt to push the technology into their established markets, while the successful entrants find a new market that values the technology.